Welcome to this special think tank edition of Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. As with our 2005 think tank, we gathered a dozen elite clinical investigators to debate the most controversial research to practice issues in management of non-small cell lung cancer. To stimulate the discussion, in the few days prior to the event, we did a survey of the faculty on challenging issues, and the results are presented in the booklet accompanying this program. For this meeting, we used a journal club type approach and focused on recent articles and meeting presentations, including the 2006 ASCO meeting. Our first topic was management of metastatic disease, and the initial database we reviewed were the continuing results of ECOG trial 4599, which was first presented at the 2005 ASCO meeting. At the 2006 meeting, a number of follow-up data sets were presented, and to begin, we asked the principal investigator of this historic trial, Dr. Alan Sandler, and my co-chair again for this think tank adventure, Dr. Tom Lynch, to focus on two very practical questions concerning patient care. One, is bevacizumab plus chemotherapy now the new standard of care as first-line treatment of patients with metastatic non-small cell who fit the eligibility of the ECOG trial? And two, should current non-protocol management mirror the 4599 approach? 6 cycles of chemotherapy plus Bev, in this case carboplatin and paclitaxel, followed by bevacizumab alone until disease progression. Agree, disagree, or in between? In general, right now, in the first-line setting, if you have a patient who would have met the 4599 entry criteria, the standard of care is chemo plus bevacizumab. That's part one.
Agree.
And the bevacizumab should be continued until disease progression.
Agree.
Tom, can you talk about why you feel that way?
I just think that's the way that Alan designed the study, and that if you're going to practice evidence-based medicine, and I think estimates are that 25% of our decisions in medicine are based on evidence, 75% aren't. But if you want those 25% to be evidence-based, I would argue that I want to treat my patients according to the way that they were designed to be treated on 4599 until we have evidence that proves otherwise. So I also like the idea of continuing Avastin after finishing the chemotherapy because of Alan's point about how there may be micrometastatic disease or smaller volume disease that you may be influencing in that setting. So until we have evidence that proves otherwise, I would continue the Avastin.
In terms of part A of that question, whether it is a standard of care in general, the way patients should be treated, when did you make that decision? When did you change your non-protocol practice?
I changed my non-protocol practice on, was it March 10th, Alan?
Oh, when the newspaper,
press
the
press release?
Yeah, whenever
release.
The press
release. I think it was April something.
April, whatever it was. Whenever the press release came out, of course, there was the issue of getting it reimbursed. But once we started finding out in Massachusetts, which is a pretty liberal state for reimbursement, liberal about other things as well, but as soon as we started getting it reimbursed, I was using it.
And I'll ask Alan the same question.
The answer is yes and yes. And it's interesting because Tom and I, of course, have been at various meetings together. And there are other so-called thought leader colleagues who don't necessarily have the same thoughts. Some of the questions have been raised, well, it's only one randomized phase 3 study and we're waiting for a second. That's fair. And what I usually reply to those folks is anybody using Tarceva? There's only one randomized phase 3 study for Tarceva, and everybody's pretty much jumped on that one. So I think that the concept of having just one is, it's nice if you can have more, but I personally wouldn't want to put a family member on another study with a control arm without bevacizumab at this point. The toxicity is there. There is more toxicity with bevacizumab than with just chemotherapy alone, but I think it's clinically acceptable.
Dr. Sandler reviewed with the group the updated findings from ECOG 4599, specifically safety and toxicity data. The incidence of hemorrhage was 4.7% in the Bev arm compared to 1.1% without Bev. The rate of febrile neutropenia was 5.4% versus 2%. As in other studies, the rates of hypertension and proteinuria were increased with bevacizumab, and overall there were 15 deaths in the bevacizumab-treated patients compared to 2 in the control group. Dr. Mark Sosinski commented on these findings.
I'm impressed with the difference in toxicity between the two arms in terms of febrile neutropenia, grade 4 neutropenia. At ASCO last year, the febrile neutropenia wasn't statistically significant. We didn't know that there were 15 treatment-related deaths on the one arm versus 2 on the other arm. So from my point of view, outside of a clinical trial setting, I think I like to know the risk-benefit ratio of this. And it's very clear from this update that there is a increased risk of toxicity by adding bevacizumab. I think the risk is worth the survival gain that one gets. But I think if you look at other regimens that may be more myelosuppressive, whether it be neutropenia or thrombocytopenia, I have a bit of concern until we have some safety data with other regimens.
Alan, what do you think the anatomy is of that increased rate in neutropenia?
Well, I think it may be related to the same process that results in an increase in response rate, that maybe there are supposedly VEGF receptors in the bone marrow, and maybe as a result, there's some impact on the bone marrow that allows for more neutropenia. What should be noted is that of the five deaths, I went back and looked at the five deaths, and four of those deaths occurred in patients 65 or older, three of them actually in 70 years and older, which we know from our ECOG database that older folks tend to have more problems with toxicity with grade 4. That's just sort of an FYI. But the incidence itself of 5 deaths is about 1%, a little over 1%. It is a little bit higher than seen with traditional chemotherapy.
Tom?
I need to see data to suggest that you can safely give bevacizumab with carboplatin and docetaxel and carboplatin gemcitabine. I suspect you can.
Right. And I do too.
So I suspect you can. And
does suspect mean you're okay with doing it in practice off a protocol?
Well, it's funny because I got asked that last night as I was driving to the airport by someone who was going to give carboplatin docetaxel. And he's a guy in practice who I know who's a terrific oncologist. He said he's done it with all of his patients, had no problems. And I think that that's probably going to be okay. But I personally don't do it off protocol until I see some data that suggests that it's safe. So I expect it will be safe. I personally struggle with that. And I've stayed with carboplatin Taxol until we have some of the initial data coming out, which we'll have very soon. It shouldn't be very long.
Ed.
The interesting thing is, do you think there might be less neutropenia with cis-based regimens as opposed to carbo, or less of these hematologic side effects in first line? I know we traditionally don't use cis in the first line, and I don't either. I use carbo. But it's just a question to pose out there. We didn't get a lot of this neutropenia with the colon cancer trials, which use alloxetine and other types of therapies. And so I'm just wondering if it's more of a myelosuppression based from the carbo regimens that we're using in lung cancer. I don't know. I just throw that out.
Is this enough to think more about growth factors, Alan, particularly in an older patient?
Well, I think the ASCO guidelines are 20% now for grade 4, right?
Yeah, it just came down at 20% risk in the first, so you're not there.
Not there.
But clearly there's toxicity. I mean, I don't think there's going to be any difference with a taxane or vinorelbine. I think the question is going to be a myelosuppressive regimen such as carbogem, which clearly you trade off. You have far less neurotoxicity, less alopecia, but more myelosuppression, and this obviously raises that concern, and particularly thrombocytopenia with bleeding. But we will have data on that shortly, because there will be these kind of dealer's choice plus bevacizumab regimens in some studies.
Ed, specifically, what chemotherapy are you combining with Bev right now?
Well, we have a study right now at Anderson where we're enrolling patients onto carbo, docetaxel, and bevacizumab, and we've got about 14 patients on. We haven't really seen too serious toxicities. We have had one person with hemoptysis who was an adenocarcinoma, non-cavitary lesion, so it shows
proximal.
That it was more central. It wasn't in the mediastinum, but it was more centrally located.
The patient survived?
Yeah, it was just a incidental hemoptysis that occurred, and we took him off. And it was interesting because the actual tumor response was cavitary. So that's the way it was responding. And we had one person who had a febrile neutropenia, but again, you expect some of that just with the chemotherapy by itself.
Interesting. Ruggiero?
I think the question of chemotherapy combinations other than carboplatin paclitaxel is almost rhetorical now, because if you think about it from a practical standpoint, it's really, I think, the gemcitabine-based doublets that remain somewhat worrisome. I think most people here and in the community feel comfortable using docetaxel as opposed to paclitaxel. I think most people have done it and have done it safely, and I'm not sure why it should be a concern. Gemcitabine is a little bit more of a concern. We do have a phase 2 study of oxaliplatin and gemcitabine with Avastin. And we haven't seen any significant complications as far as bleeding or thrombocytopenia or more episodes of febrile neutropenia than you would expect. So I think it will turn out to be okay as well. And the best evidence for that is the fact that an NCI trial, a phase 3 study in the adjuvant setting, in a setting in which you want to be extra careful about toxicities. Most people feel comfortable to include a gemcitabine-based regimen. So I think it's going to be okay.
Roy, I think one of the reasons they do is the registration trial in Europe looking at bevacizumab with chemotherapy is being done with gemcitabine combinations. And while those data are talked about, we haven't seen them, one would assume that people have looked at that database as they've gone forward. But my feeling is that we can probably use all the combinations, but I agree, we need to see the data. But my point was going to be, I was sort of impressed, you know, in the peri-ASCO update that the neutropenic fever is a bit higher and the neutropenia is a bit higher, which one would believe is a mechanistic effect of these agents. If you look, you'll see it with some of the other anti-angiogenics as well. And what I've done, I don't think we need to use growth factors yet, but I would add a mid-cycle blood count. I think that this is something that I've started to do on my patients that I'm using this drug with, because at least be aware of what's going on and then treat it if you need to.
So what are you going to do if you see a real low white count at the midpoint?
Well, I think, one, it's good to know that someone is neutropenic. Two, certainly if they nadir in the first cycle, one would then institute growth factor support after that.
Marty?
A question for Alan, because you brought up the geography question about location of tumors, which is in the patients on 4599 who had hemoptysis, where were those patients hemoptysized? Were they central tumors? Were these real adenocarcinomas or the non-otherwise specified people who probably had a squame? Because, I mean, my personal take is that it's really histology, not geography. I mean, we now have data, not really data, but at least some safety information from a CLGB trial in small cell, and actually I think ECOG also has a small cell study. If there's ever large central submucosal tumors, it's small cell, and there's no bleeding from everything I've heard. So I don't think it's a geography issue, but I don't know. Do you have any information on the 4599 bleeders?
We did a case control study that was presented at ASCO as a poster discussion where we looked at the phase 2 study and the ECOG study to see if we could address that. And not surprisingly, with the relative lack of events, particularly in the ECOG study, nothing was statistically significant. We did see that cavitation seems to be a concern, pre-existing cavitation, mm-hmm. which may potentially correlate to histology, and hemoptysis seemed to be. So we sort of reinvented the wheel with a lot of hard work, but nothing else specifically stood out. We looked at location. We looked at histology, but remember, this was not central review, so histology was pathologists throughout the country and did not see anything histology, either NOS or otherwise.
So an oncologist in practice says, Dr. Sandler, what about this patient with this big central adenocarcinoma?
What I have done and what I recommend is that you follow the ECOG 4599 guidelines, which did not include location.
All right. Mark?
I have just a practical question for Alan, and that is, I know in the ECOG trial you continued the bevacizumab until progression. How important do you think that is? Bevacizumab is not known to have single-agent activity in this disease. Is it principally augmenting the effect of chemotherapy? Is there a clear benefit afterwards? Or what's your feeling? I know we have no data, but what's your sense about that?
So I love these types of questions because I can't be wrong. But in the phase 2 study, there were, in fact, no responders in the second-line setting. However, the median survival for that group was about a year, suggesting that there may be something related beyond the chemotherapy. And the interesting fact, I think, is 5 or 6 years ago when the angiogenesis story really hit with those four mice from Judah Folkman, what we really were thinking of, what we said at the time was, there's no way that anti-angiogenesis could affect an established tumor, that the effect had to be on the micrometastatic setting or small tumors keeping them from getting bigger. Then all of a sudden, when we actually, as often happens in oncology, what we saw in the laboratory didn't translate at all to what we saw in people. And you see response rates that were higher across the board with chemotherapy bevacizumab studies. And so then the data, the experiments with Rakesh Jain and the clinical work with Ouellette suggested that there was this pruning and improvement in interstitial tumor pressures and better chemo delivery, and so it's all that effect with chemotherapies. And somehow we got lost and forgot about the other aspects. So I think it's both, and I would continue it, and that's my bias.
Roy?
The fact that we don't really have an answer on the maintenance question, it would be nice if that were tested, but I don't think it ever will be. But how is the drug really working? Is it working to enhance chemotherapy? That's one thought, to increase drug delivery, probably. Is it working directly on tumor cells? There are data now that tumor cells have VEGF receptor. And then is it working in the maintenance setting to suppress angiogenesis and endothelial and tumor cells both? So we really don't know. I think it speaks as we have many more compounds coming down the pike that we do need to do some more mechanistic studies.
Alan, what do you say to the patient in terms of risk of complication?
If I'm treating a patient and offering bevacizumab, I discuss that there's the potential for pulmonary hemorrhage that is reduced and is a rate of about 1%, and then there is a risk of neutropenic fever and complications associated. I think some of those other deaths that occur, those are the two principal ones that I think are most striking in that, and that we discuss the data and go as such. For example, hemoptysis, 5 patients who died. 1 patient had hemoptysis going into the study, shouldn't have been on. 1 patient developed hemoptysis after the first cycle, continued, and then had hemoptysis the second cycle. What would have happened to those 2 patients if they weren't on? That type of thing. So the numbers are there, and I state that there is a small but real chance of significant toxicity on study.
Ruggiero?
I believe that if we were to do the same exact trial today, we would have a much lower treatment-related death because people are much more aware, much more careful about how they select and how they follow their patients on bevacizumab. I mean, the patient Alan alluded to, the second patient, was my patient. She did have an episode of very minor hemoptysis after the first cycle. I didn't know what to make of it. This was my first patient on study, on bevacizumab. Never had treated anybody with the regimen. She was doing well. I said to myself, you know what? Let's see how this plays out. Obviously, didn't go well. And the patient died, and I feel terrible about this. It will never happen in my practice again, and if I can get this message out to everybody else in the country, you know, I hope that it never happens to anybody else. So that's what I'm trying to say. If we have a febrile neutropenia rate that is that level, you know, I think people need to be aware of that too and begin using growth factor prophylaxis because that will eliminate a pretty significant number of preventable deaths. So I think that these are true deaths, probably because of the addition of bevacizumab, but moving forward, they would be largely preventable.
And on the audio program that Rogerio is on, he described that patient. And then, Rogerio, you described a subsequent patient who had cavitation, and you stopped the bed
exactly
at that point. And she's fine. She's
absolutely
actually responding.
She's doing very well because by then I had learned my lesson.
Roy?
I'm just concerned that Rogerio mentioned he would stop the drug if the patient were having cavitation of their mass. I think that's a big problem if one practices that way because that probably is evidence of response. And Alan, can you clarify? I thought your data were that cavitation before therapy correlated, but actually cavitation also correlates with a response. So these are questions. If this drug is going to go into practice and there's going to be a call to someone every time a tumor mass cavitates, I can show you a whole series of carboplatin patients whose tumors cavitate. So I think if that's going to be in the public perception, this is going to be a very hard regimen to bring to the common practice.
I actually remember calling Alan on this other patient you just mentioned and saying, you know, what do I do? And Alan actually said, well, in your case in particular, I would stop the drug. And I think I did exactly what I had to do. And if I were to see someone in my practice tomorrow or this week or this month who develops a cavitary lesion after 1 or 2 cycles of bevacizumab, especially if it's a proximal lesion like it was in that patient, I would still stop the drug.
Marty?
I think that there's a couple of interesting points. I started out as kind of a skeptic about the efficacy of this drug, and I won't say that I'm an absolute believer, but I am certainly repentant. And the fact is, in talking to a patient, the bottom line is this is a positive trial. The outcomes are better. However, it's a positive trial in a highly selected population, and this is the message for the practicing physician. The other interesting thing is your control arm did better than any randomized study ever done in the United States, and that's because this is a very select group. And the problem as this drug enters into general practice is the tendency is not to be restricted with its use, but to be expansive with its use. And we will find more and more tendency to use it in people who did not have established safety. And I think what's coming out from this is a drug that is efficacious, but it adds significantly to the toxicity. And it does sound like at least some of those toxicities begin to cluster in the elderly. And I believe that there is data on this, particularly in colon cancer, where most of their adverse effects were also in the elderly. And I think that the lung cancer population is very different than colon and breast. Our median age is higher. They have many more significant comorbidities. And I think as this drug is used, one is going to have to be very cautious about it in patients with active cardiovascular disease, the over 70 group, the more frail population. And that's really who you have to watch out for, I think, with this.
Hack?
It is clear that based on Alan's presentation at ASCO and today's update, there's a bevacizumab toxicity, clearly. Increased mortality by 4%, et cetera. But we're dealing with the metastatic lung cancer patient, and by large, are incurable. So the concern, and we spend greater time talking about toxicity with the 4% mortality, is that a concern to the medical oncologist? Residual concern to our patient? Do they ask that, you know?
What are your thoughts?
I think it's a concern for the more oncologist than the patient. If you're a lung cancer patient, stage 4, facing a death within a year, 4% mortality, acceptable. Unlike stage 1, 2 patient, they're by and large curable.
And we'll talk about that in terms of the BEV trial or trials that are coming out in the adjuvant setting. Alan, people kind of are frustrated in breast, lung, and colon in terms of the lack of bevacizumab predictors. What was looked at in the 4599 study, and is there anything out there that you think might be promising?
We looked at several serum proteins that included VEGF, E-selectin, beta-FGF, and ICAM. And we looked at both baseline, and then with some of them, we were able to look at them after treatment. We drew blood after the second cycle of chemotherapy. Something that's kind of interesting about bevacizumab and anti-angiogenesis in general is when it was first discussed back in the late 90s or around 2000, whenever Dr. Folkman had his work with the four mice, the thought was that this concept of therapy could not possibly work in pre-established tumors. It could only work in the micrometastatic setting, preventing the neovasculature and turning the disease into a chronic illness. Remember, that was the hope. Well, then, as often happens in oncology, what you find in the laboratory doesn't translate to the clinic very well. And lo and behold, we find out that in all the studies that have chemo and bevacizumab, the response rates are much higher with the bevacizumab. And then there became subsequent work, Rakesh Jain, George Ouellette, that suggested that by pruning the neovasculature within the tumor cells, you get better drug delivery and therefore better response rates. And we forgot about the other aspect of anti-angiogenesis, the sort of potentially maintenance aspect of the micrometastatic disease. So my view at this point is that I believe that both concepts are valid. And so I think there's a reason to give with chemo and a reason for the maintenance. It would be nice if, you know, a randomized study would be done that maybe had 2 or 3 arms to sort of see whether you need the maintenance or not. But until such time, I think you're left with the phase 3 data as it is.
Tom?
We'll get that answer in ovarian cancer. Aren't they doing a large trial in ovarian cancer?
I think you're right.
Maintenance or no maintenance?
I think you're right.
I want to ask Tom, when you start a patient on chemo, Avastin right now in the first-line metastatic setting, what do you tell them about the risks, specifically in terms of numbers? What do you tell them about thoracic hemorrhage, or do you bring that up?
I do. So with Avastin, I will quote that there's an increased risk of dying from the chemotherapy. I tell them that you take your risk of dying from the chemotherapy from about 1% to about somewhere between 3% to 4%, but that I emphasize that the overall risk of dying from the disease will be reduced. And so in the end, the chance of living longer will be higher on chemotherapy with Avastin than it wouldn't be. We talk about hemoptysis and the fact that it's rare but can still happen. And, you know, we also talk about stroke and other thromboembolic phenomena, which even though they didn't pan out as being seen in Allen's study, when you look at the colorectal experience with Avastin, I think we're all pretty confident that Avastin is associated with a real but small increase in thromboembolic phenomena, which in lung cancer patients is not trivial. So, but I think, again, in the end, what drives our enthusiasm for Avastin is the fact that in a stage 4 trial, this had a substantial and clinically meaningful prolongation of survival, which is why I think all of us here would endorse using it in this setting. I just think you have to inform your patient as best you can in terms of what the risks are. But in the end, I think that most patients will think it's worth it.
Alan, can you review specifically the entry criteria for the trial and the recent updated data that you presented on the thoracic hemorrhage in terms of the characteristics of those patients?
The entry criteria were for non-squamous cell patients, no brain mets, and they were screened either with CTs or MRIs before going on. No history of hemoptysis greater than a half teaspoon. No active anticoagulation. And then they also, it was amended in the middle, no acute thrombotic event within, I think, 6 months of treatment. So those were the principal entry criteria. And then what we did, you heard the incidence of grade 3 plus pulmonary hemorrhage was roughly about 2%. I think it was 2.1%, grade 3 plus. There were 5 patients who died from pulmonary hemorrhage out of 420 patients on the bevacizumab arm. So that 1% is actually lower than what was seen on the phase 2 study in the non-squames, where it was 2 out of 53 patients. Also of note, of the 5 patients who died from pulmonary hemorrhage on the study, one patient actually had hemoptysis going into the study. Retrospect shouldn't have been put on study. A second one had scant hemoptysis after the first cycle and then developed massive hemoptysis on the second cycle when they continued treating them. So really only 3 patients died out of 420 patients if you utilized the strict ECOG criteria. So real, but actually if you'd looked at the old literature, you would have thought, hey, that's better than what we'd anticipate. But it was still greater than that seen on the chemo alone arm. So we attempted to see if there was a way to even better define the group of patients. As you know, as I mentioned in the ECOG study, we had no restrictions based on size or location of the tumor. Every subsequent study that's been done now with an anti-angiogenic agent has included some form of that, principally because people are assuming that it logically would make sense, but it's never been shown. So we went back and looked at lumping the patient data sets for the phase 2 study and the ECOG study to see whether we could find any baseline prognostic factors that would help us and if there were any radiologic factors during treatment that would help. Not surprisingly, with a small number of patients that had grade 3+ bleeds, nothing was statistically significant. There were trends that emerged that thought of interest. A baseline cavitation might be of increased risk. Baseline hemoptysis, again, re-entered the picture. But size, and we looked at 3 centimeters or greater, did not. Cavitation after treatment did not seem to. Again, small numbers. I really think our study doesn't really help all that much.
It's like 22 patients, right?
Correct.
So you're trying to find trends within 22.
So I think in histology, we even looked at the NOS. Some people have suggested that maybe NOS is...
Were these people responding?
Some were responding. In fact, I think the majority were, but you couldn't evaluate all of them. Not all of them were evaluated after treatment.
It's been said that, or thought that perhaps this is some manifestation of response. Do you believe that?
My bias is that, particularly for the squames and whatnot, that it may well be a manifestation of a brisk response to treatment, and that cavitation ultimately results, you know, abnormal vasculature, the fragile vessels within the tumor, and they bleed. And I'm not so sure that location, we looked at location next to blood vessels, we looked at location next to bronchi, none of those came out, which may or may not be that it's a fact, it's maybe we just didn't have enough patients. So my view is I'm not utilizing size or location in evaluating patients for this treatment.
As in colon and breast cancer, clinical trials are now being implemented worldwide to evaluate the role of bevacizumab as adjuvant therapy of non-small cell lung cancer, as commented on by Dr. Sandler.
The adjuvant study, it's going to be led by ECOG. It's ECOG 1505. It's going to be an international study that will include ECOG. I think SWOG, CLGB is going to participate. The National Cancer Institute Canada is going to, and also EORTC. So it's going to be a global event, 1,500 patients. The original premise, pretty straightforward, resected 1B to 3A patients, randomized to chemotherapy with or without bevacizumab, and we were going to take the European approach of dealer's choice. Any one of 4 different chemotherapy regimens, Taxol Carbo, or 3 cisplatin-based regimens, docetaxel, gem, and vinorelbin, which was set ready to go, as was pointed out by Dr. Love, was actually on the PDQ prior to ASCO, PDQ website. But when ASCO came and the update of CLGB study and the 1B study came out with paclitaxel carboplatin potentially not being as positive as it was before and statistically not positive, although my bias is somewhat different, it's now officially been changed. It will include 1B patients, 4 centimeters or greater. You'll remember the subset in the CLGB study said that 4 centimeters were benefited by chemotherapy. However, the chemotherapy in that subset is not going to be included. It's only going to be 3 cisplatin-based regimens. We're not including the paclitaxel carboplatin. And hopefully in the next couple of months, that will go forward. I hope that although this study will in fact accrue, I'll be interested to hear the folks around the table, I'm afraid that we may have a statistically and scientifically pure study, but may have a study that might be difficult to accrue. We'll see. And that's the issue.
Final comment from Tom.
I just can't think of a study that's more important in lung cancer than finding out whether or not bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting improves outcome. And I really hope that we're able to overcome some of the hurdles to accruing to studies in the adjuvant setting. As a group, the lung cancer docs have not done as well as the adjuvant colon and breast really have led the way. I don't think Alan should be expecting a massive difference here between Avastin, but I bet you that there's going to be a clinically meaningful difference in this setting. It's going to take 1,500 patients, and we have to show the discipline to accrue those 1,500 patients to these trials.
Non-small cell lung cancer has now joined lung cancer as having two targeted biologics with activity, and like colon cancer, there's great interest in combining targeted agents and possibly even eliminating chemotherapy in some patients. Dr. Roy Herbst reviewed several papers from ASCO looking at new targeted agents and combinations, and he began by discussing his own work with a combination of erlotinib and bevacizumab.
The phase 1-2 trial has already been reported in JCO. The concern was for bleeding and to not give full dose of both drugs. There was a concern about hypertension as well. So there was a dose escalation. Bottom line, you could give full dose of both drugs. That's very nice. One of the thoughts here is with targeted therapy, we combine with chemo or radiation therapy. The idea that two targeted therapies are combined and you can avoid the myelosuppression and neurotoxicity was a very attractive approach, an all-biologic regimen. And then, of course, we had 40 patients in our trial, and these data are published. Just to note that there are no brain metastases, not even treated. All the patients have non-squamous tumors, so most have adenocarcinoma. They're all heavily pretreated. All had at least one, but many had two or three priors. The response rate was reasonably high, but again, it's a two-center study. At this think tank last year, people were somewhat skeptical that the data, they came from two major centers, MD Anderson and Vanderbilt, but 65% stable disease, and we audited this. The fact that 85% of patients did not progress at 8 weeks, confirmed 4 weeks later, were quite nice. Median survival of 12.6 months and the one-year survival of 50+%. Toxicity-wise, mostly rash and diarrhea, low grade, no hemoptysis in a selected trial at two centers. So these data look good, especially in reference to BR21. So we went forward with a randomized phase 2 trial, a very conservative development plan. This is a 120-patient study. Actually, I think it's very significant that Lou Fehrenbacher presented these data at ASCO from Kaiser. So really, this was taken to the community. Let's see how the data hold up. It was expanded a little bit, one of these trials designed by committee. So there's chemotherapy with docetaxel pemetrexed plus placebo, chemotherapy, docetaxel pemetrexed plus bevacizumab, and then you have bevacizumab or erlotinib, 40 patients in each arm. The bottom line is bevacizumab enhances in the second-line setting both with the EGFR inhibitor erlotinib or with chemotherapy. Now, these results are reasonably good as far as time to progression, but because the numbers are small, the hazard ratio is 0.66 for the chemo combination or 0.72 for erlotinib. The hazard ratios, the 95% confidence intervals, do cross 1, so these are not statistically significant data at this time, but they're suggestive of the trend and certainly help confirm the data from the early trial. And then you can merge the two arms that got bevacizumab either with chemotherapy or with erlotinib versus the arm one, the control, either pemetrexed or docetaxel. And again, this is just borderline significant now. But again, it looks like things are certainly moving in the right direction. The next step is phase 3, but certainly one feels more enthusiastic about phase 3 at this point. Now, toxicity and drug discontinuation due to AE, and much less for the arm that got the less toxic EGFR bevacizumab combination, SAEs significantly less. But full disclosure, bleeding was seen now with this drug, both with bevacizumab and erlotinib. One of them was a hemoptysis, a death. And in the 40 patients who got bevacizumab chemotherapy, there were grade 5 drug-related AEs, 3 patients with hemoptysis. No patients had hemoptysis on the chemotherapy alone. So toxicity-wise, the bevacizumab and erlotinib combination looked a bit better as far as the decreased need for drug discontinuation. SAEs were far fewer. But grade 5 deaths, there was one grade 5 death on the bevacizumab and erlotinib arm, and that was due to hemoptysis. There were 3 on the bevacizumab chemotherapy arm, and 2 of those were due to hemoptysis. And there were 2 on the chemotherapy alone arm, and none of those were due to hemoptysis. So this is 3 deaths from hemoptysis in about 80 patients. So it's a smaller trial, but about the same levels that were seen in the ECOG study. My strong feeling is that these data support the phase 3 studies. There might be some groups that say, well, why not just use the combination? I don't think we nearly have enough data yet for that. But we certainly have enough data to be very enthusiastic about the beta trial, which is looking at 650 patients in the second-line setting with erlotinib placebo versus erlotinib bevacizumab. This is well over 200 in its accrual now, picking up after ASCO. And then the ATLAS trial frontline, which is a very nice trial. It's giving us chemotherapy combination data with different drugs plus the bevacizumab and then randomizing to bevacizumab with placebo, basically the ECOG arm, and then bevacizumab or erlotinib. Those of you remember from the TRIBUTE study, there was a suggestion that erlotinib maintenance had an effect. Now, perhaps the effect is greater with the bevacizumab. Just in the remaining seconds that I have, ZD6474, the idea being that here's a molecule that has both activities in the same molecule, potentially more convenient, potentially less expensive, but the bottom line is it's not quite as good an EGF inhibitor as it is a VEGF inhibitor. So that's one of the concerns. Would it be better to have the single drugs and dial them up as you want them, or to have it all in one pill? So basically, this is the trial that Ron Natale presented, a randomized double-blind crossover multicenter study looking at glofitinib versus ZD6474, second or third line non-small cell lung cancer. The primary endpoint was progression-free survival, and there were 167 patients. And the data from this trial did meet its primary endpoint, progression-free survival. The ZD6474 was superior to glofitinib, 11 weeks versus 8.1 weeks. The hazard ratio was 0.69. Response rates were low for both. The ZD6474, 8%, and glofitinib, 1%, especially unusual in a trial of this drug reported by Ron. Post-crossover, no additional responses, and actually, there was a bit more stability and disease control in the arm that got ZD6474 afterwards. However, the overall survival factors, the glofitinib group actually did better, the group that got the glofitinib first, 7.4 versus 6.1 months, sort of speaking to the difficulties in doing survival trials in this day and age. Maybe this is real, maybe it's an artifact of whatever treatment patients got afterwards. About half this trial was done in Eastern European countries. And toxicity-wise, this drug behaves very much like an EGFR inhibitor by itself. No hemoptysis was reported. The trial that John Hamak presented, which was looking at the drug ZD6474 in the second-line setting, this trial basically looked at three arms, either a placebo with docetaxel at 75, ZD6474 at 100 milligrams plus docetaxel at 75, or ZD6474 at 300 milligrams plus docetaxel at 75. And these data were updated at this year's ASCO, but at the 100 milligram dose, the trial met its primary endpoint, which was progression-free survival, 18.7 versus 12.0 weeks. Didn't quite make it, though it was trending in that direction in the arm at 300 milligrams. Why low dose better than high dose? A number of potential explanations. Perhaps this is basically working as a VEGF inhibitor at 100 milligrams, and that's a thought. You saw the IC50 for EGFR was a lot higher. So one possibility is that this is basically an angiogenesis inhibitor plus chemotherapy in the second line setting. When you add the good EGF inhibition, maybe you see an antagonism, as we've seen in other trials. This randomized trial is now ongoing. It's accruing patients already in multiple countries. 1,240 patients getting ZD6474 docetaxel, blinded to placebo versus docetaxel. The endpoint is disease progression, and that's an accepted endpoint for the study, though certainly one would want to see survival going in the right direction as well.
After the presentation by Dr. Herbst, I asked Dr. Miller what he thought about these new data on the bevacizumab-erlotinib combination.
I have used this combination in patients. I've used it either in the maintenance setting, say in someone who'd been on erlotinib and we're trying to at least theoretically delay the time to progression, and I've used it as a non-cytotoxic doublet in second or third line setting.
Ed?
I just saw a patient the other day who asked me about Tarceva first line. She was a older 70-year-old female who was a non-smoker. They also asked about Avastin and Tarceva front line. And so my discussion with them included everything inside the box, which is chemo doublet Avastin, and then outside the box with biologics, with Tarceva Avastin, and sort of posed it. She was there with her three very educated sons and husband, and we just had a long discussion, and the Avastin data came up. I said, yes, there is a higher chance that you may die from the therapy, but there's also a better chance you'll live longer on the therapy. That argument of the toxicities, and we opted finally to go with Tarceva first line with her because her bulk of disease was very low, but any chemo plus Avastin would have been very appropriate for her as well.
One of the most common questions related to the use of bevacizumab with any cancer is the current relative or perhaps absolute contraindication in patients with brain metastases. In our faculty survey, we asked, quote, have you used or would you consider using bevacizumab in a patient with brain metastases? Of great interest is that half the faculty answered yes and half no.
I answered it no. I've never used bevacizumab in people who have brain mets. Now, we're participating in the trial to answer that question, as I'm sure many of the people around the table are, where patients get their brain mets radiated first and then they get treatment, and we'll have a sense of assessing toxicity and assessing what happens. But I really think that because of the restrictions that Alan placed on eligibility in his trial, I think you've got to follow in this setting, because of safety, an evidence-based approach, and I have not been using it in this setting.
Resected brain met.
Resected brain met the same way. They would not have been included in Alan's study.
Right.
How many of you would consider bevacizumab in a patient with a completely resected brain met?
I think after a long while, perhaps.
Even the clinical trials require 6 months.
Yes. That would be the time period that I would feel comfortable
Vince?
With. Yeah.
I think that, correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't we amending the current clinical trials to allow people with previously rated brain metastases? I mean, these contraindications have relative degrees of contraindication. Certainly, squamous histology and hemoptysis are a much more powerful contraindication than the one intracranial bleed in a phase one trial or whatever it was of bevacizumab. I mean, we're doing, this drug is incredibly active in or in combination in GBM, huge tumors with lots of edema, and we're undertaking big approval strategy trials there. So I have, and we usually get the blessing of a neurologist on board that it's okay to do it, but we certainly have done this.
Roy, you say the key thing, Vince, the trials are being amended, and I think in the setting of a clinical trial,
absolutely,
this is a question that has to be asked. It was somewhat arbitrary the way it was done. The data are emerging. The beta trial, for example, is being amended. The Atlas trial is amended. But the problem is to do it in common practice with all the other concerns, I would wait until the data are out there. I suspect that they will be there very soon, but there is a trial called Passport,
right,
which is basically looking to see if you can give any chemotherapy with Avastin in patients with previously treated brain mets. We have that trial open, and we'll use it for this group of patients.
Alan?
My view is that there's more lawyers than physicians in America, and I just think that you don't have a leg to stand on if something bad happens. Do I think we're going to be able to do it? I certainly do, but I think at this point, unless a patient is pretty adamant, is one of those super informed folks who has reams and reams of papers and is willing to state that they understand the risk and wish to proceed, I would consider it, but I have yet to do it.
It's really funny you bring that up, Alan, because I had two doctors who called me, so they weren't referred patients, but they were out in practice, and the patients specifically came to them and said, I want Avastin, even though I have brain mets. And they asked me, what would you do? And my response was similar to Alan's. It's just, I don't know how much informed consent you can give
right. If
something bad happens.
Final comment from Marty.
What I would say is that as far as the brain met issue, I think that that probably was a little bit overcautious. I mean, you did have patients that I think on 4599 who developed brain mets during this as part of their progression and did not have any significant issues with that. So that may be an area of overcaution. However, as has been pointed out, the data will be there very shortly. The studies have been amended. It's being monitored extremely closely, and the information regarding brain metastases will be there pretty quickly, and we'll know. And I think, once again, the thing that we are seeing from 4599 is this is a good regimen in a good performing status group of patients, and I would err on the side of fairly extreme caution before bringing it into others based on some of what I've seen and heard about in colon cancer as you bring it into a greater, more elderly population, which in a way is more analogous to the lung cancer population.